from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll preview this year's early music festival.
Then I'll learn from poet Kyle Craig about Haiga, which combines haiku and visual art.
And I'll take a look at Indiana in 200 Objects at the State Museum. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. This year marks the 50th Indianapolis Early Music Festival, and the season opens with a celebration of Shakespeare with the Baltimore Consort and actors from the IRT. Travis DiNicola spoke with the festival's Sylvia Scott to find out more about this concert and the entire summer series.
Sylvia, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Absolutely. It's always great to talk about this regular traditional summer festival, and now in its 50th year, which is absolutely amazing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. We're very excited.
I'm sure. I want to talk about the specifics of this year's festival in just a minute, but I have to say that the article that Jay Harvey wrote about the early music festival that was in the Early Music America magazine is just fantastic. It's great history. I didn't realize some of that history. I mean, obviously, with 50 years, there's a lot of history, but sort of how it all evolved and how it's developed and changed over the years.
One of my greatest joys this year as president of the board has been, while planning for the 50th, learning about its history and the group of people that brought it about, and also the fact that we are the nation's longest continually running early music festival.
That's pretty
amazing.
Through
good shepherding of resources and generous giving through people.
So tell me a little bit about just the early history, if you will, because and see if I've got some of this right. I mean, basically, you had a lot of musicians from the symphony who weren't working during the summer. This was before the days of Connor Prairie, and people around here were, you know, knew of things like Tanglewood and other things and wanted to have some sort of classical music during the summer, right?
Right. And I'm a little unsure on some of those particulars. Mm-hmm. I do know that there were ISO musicians and that they played for some of the very first concerts under the direction, I believe, of Michael Palmer.
Okay.
And we're, I think, looking him down to interview him. Mm-hmm. He's currently at the Bellingham Festival in Washington State.
Okay.
Then we had Frank Cooper come, and that's when I started attending many years down the road. I've been mm-hmm. attending for over 20 years, probably closer to 30 now. And I loved Frank Cooper's lectures, and then the quality of the early music presented just set me off.
Yeah, obviously. So for people who may not be familiar, how do you define early music? What's the time period here?
Very good question. For our purposes, we define early music as music before, generally speaking, 1750.
Okay.
So, broadly speaking, we're talking about Baroque music and before that, Renaissance music, mm-hmm. and before that, of course, medieval music. But one of the things that I have appreciated so much is that we also draw in world music that's old.
Hmm.
One
mm-hmm.
summer, we had one of the drummers from the Silk Road Project, Yo-Yo Ma's project, come in and show us, you know, ancient and probably current, actually, Mongolian drumming techniques and singing. And we've had a singer from Morocco in with music. And I've music from the Gypsies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very educational as well as inspiring.
Well, it's a big part of the mission, of course. And I mean, this year will be no different. Seven great concerts, all at the Indiana History Center there. And kicking it off, this concert to me is just really intriguing. On Friday, June 17th, the If Music Be the Food of Love. This is basically a sort of a look at the music of Shakespeare's time, as well as music inspired by different Shakespeare plays, including The Tempest. And you're going to have actors there and the Baltimore concert. This sounds like a great show.
Oh, I'm so excited about that. And I will be one of the many ISO musicians out at Symphony on the Prairie that night, so won't be able to be there There are
that is your day job.
There are some of us
or
on the board.
Job, I suppose,
yes, right. And so, but several people in the ISO are interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
These are the shoulders we stand on.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit more about that concert. So the actors from the IRT, what will they be doing that night?
Well, I know that they will be doing some scenes from Shakespeare's plays.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be, the Baltimore Consort will be presenting music from Shakespeare's plays and dances from that time. Music that might have been heard at the plays.
Okay.
So it's really putting the drama of William Shakespeare with the music from his time.
And of course, this is the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare.
It's an amazing year for anniversaries.
It is.
400th, 200th, 100th, and 50th.
Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to kick off the season. What follows after that? The Baltimore Concert continues to stay in town for a little bit and perform?
Yes. One of the things I like to tell people about, especially those who aren't familiar with early music and really don't want to commit to buying a ticket,
mm-hmm.
we have the Family Concert on Saturday, June 8th at 11 a.m. 18th, excuse
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And it is free to the public. It is free to, as I say, children of all ages, myself included. And hoping a few people will come in concert in costume this year. But the Baltimore Consort has a very kind of interactive concert with the children and adults, usually teaching them a song and or a dance. And afterwards, there is not actually an instrument petting zoo, but they can come up on stage and see in detail, up close and personal, all the instruments.
And some of the instruments are traditional classical instruments, but some are also quite unique to the time period.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely, depending on the group presenting. Mm-hmm. Of course, the viols, the gambas are very similar to our grouping of violins, violas, cellos mm-hmm. today. But they have frets, and they do have their distinctions. But many of the woodwind, percussion, precursors of the guitar mm-hmm. are very interesting.
I would imagine so. So yeah. You said costumes. What should people be dressing up?
Well, we've said anything from the time, mm-hmm. anything from any of the times.
Very good. So so again, the big opening night with the Shakespeare concert on Friday the 17th, the Free Family concert on Saturday the 18th, and then on Sunday the 19th, you have another performance.
Yes, Rachel Barton Pine. Wonderful violinist who has also delved into early music and has become a very sought-after artist to collaborate with. And collaborating with her is one of the most renowned harpsichordists in the world, Jory Vinokur.
Excellent. And that will be a program of Bach sonatas?
Yes.
Excellent. That'll be beautiful. And then you jump to the next weekend, Friday, June 24th.
There we go, from Barcelona. Javier Diaz Torre. He will be giving a solo recital on the theobo and the baroque guitar.
What is that instrument? The theobro?
It's theorbo.
Okay.
And it is, if you know what a lute looks like, mm-hmm. which looks like an almond shell on steroids mm-hmm. with the frets and the neck attached. And then stretch that neck another, I don't know, foot and a half maybe.
Uh-huh.
And you have a theorbo. It has drone strings and it has playing strings. It's quite complicated to play, but really an exquisite instrument.
Very cool. Interesting.
Exquisite instrument.
And then also that weekend on Sunday the 26th.
That
if you started with from Barcelona, you go to from London.
Yes. And speaking of the lute, we have Jakob Lindberg performing with probably the most well-known voice of early music, which is Dame Emma Kirkby. I grew up listening to Christopher Hogwood's recordings with her singing. And she is just an amazing artist that really inspired a generation of singers to go into early music.
Excellent. Then, of course, you take a break for the July 4th weekend and jump to the weekend of Friday, July 8th. Yeah. Tell me about that show.
Les Délices with Shannon Mercer. It's a group of French Baroque musicians, mm-hmm. musicians concentrating in the music from the French Baroque, with a singer presenting music from the time of Handel and mostly Handel's music.
Okay.
So we're talking about, let's see, born in 1685. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't forget these things. So we're talking about the late 1700s, 1600s and early 1700s.
Okay.
The height of the opera and cantata writing period.
Excellent. And then the final concert on Sunday, July 10th.
Yes, this is hopefully the first of competitions that mm-hmm. we have worked very hard to birth. And the finals of the Indianapolis International Baroque Competition will be that final concert. We have five finalists from around the world playing their respective instruments. It's open to any instrument. And I know we include a Baroque trumpet among the finalists this year. Two woodwinds and two string players, I believe.
Now, how did these finalists become finalists? Did this competition took place over the past year or so, or how did that work?
When we began talking about making a competition, starting a competition, we met with Tom Biskevich, who was the man who helped get the Indianapolis International Violin Competition up and running. And then Glenn Kwok, who is now the head of that competition.
Yes.
And they gave so very generously of their time to educate us and inspire us to continue on with this idea. And so back in January, before January, the competition was announced.
Okay.
And then I think we had a January 15th cutoff date for submitting entries. And then I believe we informed people by March 15th.
Okay.
And we received a...
Now, were they judged by recordings that they sent, or was there any...
Yes, okay. Video recordings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we found people who were knowledgeable in each of those areas to review the tapes, and then it went to a final committee which viewed all of the tapes that were submitted from each of the string players, the keyboard mm-hmm. players, the woodwind players, etc.
So this will be the first time that these finalists have all performed here in Indianapolis, then, or together at least? Or
as far as we know, yes.
Yeah, that's great.
And they each will present a Baroque concerto, mm-hmm. generally about 20 minutes length in total. And so we will have all five perform in the same evening, and the voting
Wonderful.
Will happen at that time with the judges.
Ah, so the true grand prize winner will emerge from that.
Exactly. We also have an audience favorite this year, mm-hmm. and the audience will vote on their favorite. And we will also have the Indianapolis Baroque Orchestra's prize.
That's great. Where did you get entries from? Was it, all over the world? Or?
All over the world, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Excellent. So what is it that you would recommend for people who may not be as familiar with early music to listen for or to try to experience when they attend the festival?
To be open-minded. Early music, I just found this out recently. Early music originally was sort of the offspring of the folk music. As you go farther back in folk music, if you listen to a good Appalachian fiddle tune, you're also listening to a good Shakespearean fiddle tune, or at least from around those times. And if you go back far enough in music, it's all one and the same,
mm-hmm.
with very many different
branches of the
branches, tree. Depending on the country and the culture. One of my favorite concerts from the past was called The Music of Spain, The Golden Age of Spain, when the Moors, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews lived together in harmony in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And during that concert, they took the same tune and showed how it would have been performed depending on the culture.
Hmm. How fascinating.
Oh, very.
Great music and great history.
Yes. So if you love folk music, mm-hmm. if you love dancing, if you love Shakespeare, and if you just have a sense of adventure and want to learn something new, this is the place for you.
Excellent. Sylvia, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
Travis DiNicola with Sylvia Scott from the Indianapolis Early Music Festival, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this summer. For a complete listing of all their concerts, visit emindy.org, as in early music indie, emindy.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
If you're a writer who also likes the visual arts, or a visual artist who likes to write, listen up. The Writers' Center of Indiana has a two-session class this month that will teach you the Japanese form of haiga, which combines haiku and visual art. Sharon Gamble invited instructor Kyle Craig to our studio to learn more.
Haiga? Am I saying it correctly?
Haiga. Yeah.
Haiga? Mm-hmm. Tell us about this art form and tell us how you discovered it.
It's a Japanese art form that combines haiku and visual images. You can hear in haiga the high of haiku, and then the word ga in haiga means painting. So it's literally means haiga means haiku paintings or haiku plus images. I discovered it through writing haiku and other Japanese forms, and discovered that some of the ancient masters who wrote haiku actually juxtaposed their writings with their paintings or images to kind of enhance the art form and hope that each one, the writing and the image, kind of mutually enhance the other.
I heard you recite some haiku as part of the Before I Die Festival a few weeks ago, and I was struck by a couple of things. First of all, in your introduction, you talked about haiku has evolved from the strict syllable form that maybe we learned back in school. Do I remember that correctly?
That's correct. One of the things that people are surprised to find is if they encounter haiku in journals today, they're often not always written in the 5-7-5 syllable count. The reason for that is it has to do with the Japanese language versus the English language. Probably the easiest way to describe that is if we take something like modern haiku, those two words, we would say in English there's four syllables, mm-hmm. You know, two syllables in each word. In Japanese, the anji, which literally means like sound symbols or sound units, in modern there's four sounds, and in haiku there's three. So for them, that would be seven sounds. So when they said they're writing in 5-7-5, we translated it as English syllables, and we eventually discovered that they don't quite match up.
They don't line up. They don't. It's like when kids for a while were trying to understand the metric system and having trouble with that math conversion.
That's right.
So why a Japanese art form? What led you there?
I was taking classes at the Indiana Writers Center in poetry and writing free verse poems and taking classes with, for instance, Sherry Wagner is our current poet laureate. She teaches poetry there, and I was taking classes with her and writing some poems and even getting, you know, a few published here and there. And I had a friend who was a Japanese studies minor and was wanting to write poetry. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those people, like many of us, who wanted to write but talked about writing a lot and had more trouble putting the pen or pencil to paper. So I gave him the challenge or assignment, why don't you write 5 haiku? And I'm one of those people that doesn't like to give out anything without doing it myself. So I took this challenge upon myself, and I started to really discover that in that haiku, for such a brief form, there's so much more involved in it. I started to really appreciate how, even though very simple and accessible, how it's also very complex, especially the way they kind of take two different things and juxtapose them. I think you mentioned the Stutz art gallery reading earlier, mm-hmm. and there was, I think, one I read there that was late stage Alzheimer's, a swan disappears into the mist. And so in that short haiku, you know, there's the juxtaposition of a human condition along with the natural world. And just the way that haiku writers are able to put those together and juxtapose them, I think is really impressive. And then when you add haiga and add an image, there's just another layer of juxtaposition. So
I didn't warn you I was going to ask you this, so if you don't want to do it, just say let's not. But do you have in your head some of the other ones from the Before I Die Festival? You could give us a couple of your favorites.
I do have a few. I could read.
Let's
see.
And would you do what you did at the Before I Die Festival and say them twice?
Sure, I'd love to. High noon, my toddler pours invisible tea. High noon, my toddler pours invisible tea. Gun violence, the way ink spreads on rice paper. Gun violence, the way ink spreads on rice paper. Family piano, each key out of tune. Family piano, each key out of tune. My daughter's eyes, the way raindrops cling to irises. My daughter's eyes, the way raindrops cling to irises. Moth wings, the folding and unfolding of laundry. Moth wings, the folding and unfolding of laundry.
You know what strikes me about these? They're so beautiful. They're these vignettes. They're very economical of language. And in your style in particular, you're going from a general concept to a definition or a fine-tuning of that concept. Your daughter's eyes, but then you say how they appear to you.
Mm-hmm.
Or gun violence, and you say a metaphor for it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you think of them when you're writing them? Does a concept come to you and then you say, what is the best way to illustrate that? Is that what your process is like?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people who write haiku are out in the world, whether they're taking walks or taking pictures and photography, and kind of have this experience or witness something, and they trying to capture that moment. And I think then when you sit down to write the moment, sometimes the fun part, at least for me in the creative process, is finding kind of that old poetry adage of show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out how can I best, in such a brief form, get this little snapshot or this little revelation into a couple of things. And so I do think I put that takes a lot of time, more time and effort than one might suspect.
Absolutely. And I promise we'll get back to the haiga, to the adding of a visual image. But your day job is?
I'm a mental health counselor. Yeah.
And so in your day job, you're dealing with words, 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 thousands, millions of an outpouring of words.
Mm-hmm.
From your clients, I'm guessing.
That's correct, yeah.
Is it any kind of therapy for you to be dealing with such economy of language in this other part of your being?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I've ever even put those two things together or thought of it that way. And I do think, I view writing haiku as a bit of a meditation for me. Often, if I were writing prose, I might just sit down and let it spill out of my mind. But with haiku, I'm often sitting with myself and kind of waiting, and kind of it feels like meditation for me. And when you think meditation, sometimes you think meditation without words. So I do kind of like the idea of it, the economy of words being important to it. I see that in my creative process between my professional work and when I teach. When I sit with someone for my job, I'm trying to understand them and understand their story. And that usually, in doing so, it leads me to a greater appreciation of the person, their story, where they've been. And that kind of opens up this capacity for empathy. And I feel like when we write, or I teach writing, my goal is that people sort of learn to understand what it is we're dealing with and spend some time with it. And the more they understand it, the more they learn to start appreciating it And the more they appreciate it, the more they want to kind of maybe hopefully develop that capacity to write themselves and open that up within themselves.
And in this upcoming class, which has the two sessions on Sunday, June 12th and Sunday, June 26th, you'll be guiding people. Which comes first, the writing or the visual part?
It'll be a little bit of both. In the first session, I'm going to basically go through a lot of Haiga samples, and so we'll practice learning and writing about our own haiku, but also some of the prompts might be like, you know, writing haiku from images or vice versa. And then and while we will do some sketching and drawing and things in the first session, the second session will be also a lot more experimental with, we'll do some brush painting, we'll talk about photography, Haiga, and do a lot more kind of group exercises.
Are Haiga ever collaborative, like you write, I take the photo, or that kind of thing?
Yes, they are. And that's another fun thing. I think of all Japanese like forms or poetry forms, is there's often a sense of collaboration that, like, haiku originally were linked verses where one person wrote and then the next person followed. And so Haiga follows that pattern of even Basho, the famous Japanese haiku master. He liked to have his pupil draw most of the images because he felt like his pupil was a better artist than him.
Uh-huh.
And then he would write, because he was a great writer, would write the haiku.
Division of labor.
That's right.
Knowing what you're good at. How do you know when a haiku is done? Do you do a lot of editing? Do you start with 50 words and trim it down to 10, or what is your process? Or do they just kind of float into your mind in this meditative process, more or less done?
Yeah, I would say both occur for me, where sometimes, you know, in those lucky moments, you get things that float into your mind that are roughly close to what you want. But more often than not, I do a bit of editing, which I think sometimes people find surprising in haiku because it's already such a short form.
Right.
I even run the Indianapolis Haiku Group, which is a group that meets monthly, and we spend a little bit of time on, like, you know, people bringing forth their haiku and trying to help them edit it. Like, well, I think it's close, but it seems like it's not quite there. And so, like other forms of poetry, yeah, we do edit, and sometimes, as far as when it's done, it's kind of that old poetry thing of poems are never finished, they're just abandoned.
And in print or online. How many people come to the haiku group, and do you meet at the Writers' Center?
We average anywhere from, you know, 7 to 8 people. Sometimes we have as many as 12, and sometimes 5 or 6. But what we've been doing, we've met at the Writers' Center before, but we generally meet at, because I email everybody, and we generally meet at somebody's home.
Mm-hmm.
and everyone's been pretty comfortable with that so far, and it's been kind of a really nice kind of hosting event where we all, you know, get to know one another and get to practice. So.
And my last question, if you're tuning in and going, I want to know more about that, stay tuned, we'll give you some contact information, but how does teaching affect you as a writer and artist?
Teaching has been, well, it's been a real blessing for me, in the sense that it really affects me in to slow down, which I guess is always important in any form of writing, but to kind of slow down and think about how I would want something presented to me. I think about, I've been to lots of workshops and writing seminars, and I think about, like, oh, it would have been nice if we'd done this, or it would have been nice if we'd done that. And so I've tried to take all those things over the years and kind of be like, here's what, you know, I would want if I were taking a class, and mm-hmm. what I think I would get the most out of. So I think it's gone pretty well. And then as a writer, it's really helped me. I feel like I'm more focused because I've put more thought behind what I'm doing. So sometimes people talk about breaking it apart between the creative side of the brain and the editing side of the brain. But sometimes when you if you edit enough things and know enough, then sometimes it helps when you do go to sit and write that it might come out just a little sharper.
Sharon Gamble with Writers Center of Indiana instructor Kyle Craig. Kyle's class in Haiga is on Sunday, June 12th and Sunday, June 26th from 1:30 to 4:30 in the afternoon. You do not need any previous experience in haiku or visual art. And you can learn much, much more at indianawriters.org. Again, indianawriters.org.
Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Well, officially it's not summer yet. That's not for another week and a half, but you couldn't tell that by the number of summer festivals that are happening this weekend in the very near future.
Busiest weekend in Indianapolis,
it's
it seems.
It's crazy. And we're going to tell you about it on our fast calendar we call
What Do We Do?
What do
How
you
many
have?
Events can we get
I
in?
Know,
you
right?
know, now, Zubilation, which is sold out, that's Friday night. But lots of other great events that you can still get to this weekend, including I'll start with Talbot Street Art Fair, of course, going on the 11th and 12th on Talbot Street. Near the Old Heron School, which is where the Heron High School is located, with lots of artists, 270 artists from across the nation with this free show.
Fantastic. Also going on this weekend, if you are hungry from shopping at the Talbot Street Art Fair, don't forget the Italian Street Festival is this Friday and Saturday from 5 to 11 p.m. You do need to take some cash with you, because the way you get your food and beverage is you buy tickets and then you spend the tickets on food and beverage. But there's a complete lineup. There's a processional, there's music, and there is the aforementioned food and drink.
There you go. And, of course, Pride Week continues with the Cadillac Barbie Pride Parade starting at 10 o'clock on Mass Ave on Saturday morning, followed by the whole Pride Festival, which takes place on the American Legion Mall, which is just huge with thousands of performances and vendors and more and all sorts of stuff going on Saturday.
Don't forget the Indiana Handicraft Exchange is also this weekend on the 11th from noon to 8. What it is a perfect way to spend a fun summer day. Vendors include local clothing and jewelry designers, as well as some of Indiana's favorite names, including T-shirt producers, United States of Indiana, Lick Ice Cream, and, as they say, much, much more. It's all happening at the Harrison Center alongside the Independent Music and Art Festival.
Which is also at the Harrison Center.
Which is also at the Harrison Center. So much.
Yeah. Something else going on this weekend. NAMI does the Great American Antiques Market usually every fall, but they're doing a spring market this year as well. It's at the Basile Opera Center on Saturday and Sunday as well. And this is a fundraiser for NAMI, and there will be some great antiques to shop at the antique market.
Fantastic. I want to give you a tiny sneak peek of one or two things coming up next weekend, because I know the fun is spread out a little bit. Hey, Indy's most popular beer festivals, Brouhaha, returns. This is the, can it be, 20th year, right in front of the Phoenix Theater's current longtime home on Park Avenue at St. Clair Streets. And that is something you want to get your ticket ahead of time for, because it does sell out. It's 3 to 7 next Saturday, June 18th.
Well, if you want to go inside this weekend, because almost everything else was outside,
right?
You may want to check out the Symphony on Friday at 8 o'clock or Sunday at 3 o'clock. They're performing Carmen. And
this
is led by
this.
Music director Christoph Urbanski, and it should be pretty awesome. So that is this weekend as well.
Love, love, love it. Don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis is Indie Arts Guide. And also, we'll be back next weekend with more events you can see and do on our calendar that we call...
What do we call, Sharon?
What will we do? Festival edition, right?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
As part of the celebration of Indiana's bicentennial, the Indiana State Museum is currently exhibiting Indiana in 200 Objects through the rest of the year. The exhibition is organized into 9 themes addressing aspects of Hoosier life and history. Travis DiNicola spoke with Chief Curator Dale Ogden to learn more.
Dale, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Good to be here, Travis. Thanks.
Absolutely. Of course, it's the bicentennial, and everyone knows that. There's been some really interesting ways that different organizations are celebrating that. I think this is one of the most intriguing ones. 200 objects at the State Museum. Tell me about how this idea came to be, and then we'll talk more about the specific show.
Well, with the 200th anniversary, this is obviously a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Indiana and the various cultural institutions in Indiana to have this kind of celebration. I make the comment that I'm the only one that I know that plans on being here for the tricentennial. So we wanted to do something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't just kind of reproduce a different version of what we normally do at the State Museum. So we wanted to approach it a little more uncommonly and I think a little more creatively than we would normally approach some projects.
So you, with coming up with the idea of 200 objects, obviously an object for every year,
right.
You also have subcategories within that, right?
Right. Yeah. I spent some time talking to people about what the exhibition is not, because we don't want to give people the wrong impression. This is not the 200 most important objects in Indiana history. It's not the 200 best artifacts in the State Museum collection. It's 200 objects that we think collectively tell interesting and unusual stories about the state of Indiana.
Okay.
So rather than just presenting them chronologically, or linearly the way we normally do, we've grouped them into categories that don't necessarily seem to have anything in common.
Such as
one of my favorite categories is bad to the bone.
Okay.
We have a giant short-faced bear, a skeleton of a giant short-faced bear that's mounted on exhibit. And he was a mean critter. He was probably the apex predator in this area in the late Ice Age period. Stood about 9 feet tall, ran 40 miles an hour. He was just a bad man. He's in the same category with John Dillinger, the original public enemy number one, who was also a bad man in a different sense. In that same area, we have an All-NBA trophy for Larry Bird. He was a bad man on the basketball court. Amelia Earhart, who wasn't a bad man, but she was a bad woman. You know, she got in her plane
in the best way possible.
In the best way possible.
So you mentioned for Dillinger, what's the artifact there?
We have an original wanted poster. He was J. Edgar Hoover's original public enemy number one.
Yeah.
And this is a poster that would have been distributed to various post offices around the country.
Okay.
Wanted at the time that he was wanted for the murder of an East Chicago policeman.
You mentioned a trophy for Larry Bird. Uh-huh. For Amelia Earhart, what's the object there?
Well, hopefully there are quite a bit of interesting facts about Indiana that people aren't going to be familiar with in this exhibition. It's, a little different than sort of the traditional kind of things that we would exhibit. Amelia Earhart was a part-time professor at Purdue University. She also flew an airplane very often that was put together by engineers at Purdue University. She was kind of one of the founding mothers, I would say, of the aviation program at Purdue. And they have a flight jacket that she wore, and that's on loan to us for this, a flight jacket from Amelia Earhart that she wore while serving as an instructor at Purdue.
So how many of the objects that are in the 200 are on loan, and how many are from the museum's permanent collection?
Because that's
a really extensive collection there.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We could have done this exhibition entirely out of our own collection. We have about 400,000 artifacts in our collection. And obviously, we could have selected 200 that would have made for an interesting exhibition. About 140 of the 200 are from our collection.
Okay.
We have 40 partners in this project who have loaned about 60 artifacts. As I said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And we want to take advantage of it in many different ways. One of those ways is to reach out to other institutions around the state. There are fine regional museums in Fort Wayne, South Bend, Terre Haute, Evansville. It's an opportunity for us to either connect or reconnect with those institutions, as well as University of Notre Dame, Purdue, as we just mentioned, Indiana University.
Include them, promote them, because it is the entire state that's celebrating.
It's the entire state that's celebrating, and as the state museum, we felt that we had an obligation to make sure that the people in St. Joseph's County and in Allen County and in Tippecanoe County felt that they were that they had a stake in this project, that they had something that they could contribute to it, and something that they could look forward to seeing as a part of the project.
Now, of course, if you asked anyone, you know, what 200 objects they would choose to represent Indiana's history, you'd get a lot of different answers.
Sure.
I'm really intrigued by how you and your team at the State Museum came up with a specific 200. I know you mentioned the categories, but, you know, were there certain things where you're going around the room and like, okay, we know we have to have something from Larry Bird.
Right.
We'll figure that out later, but we've got that covered. You know, oh, let's make sure we have Amelia Earhart or things like, I mean, how did that sort of, that must have been a really long and interesting conversation.
It was an interesting, that's a good word. We had 12 different curators working on this project. In most exhibitions, you have one, maybe two, and the project is sort of driven by the vision or by the priorities, the agenda of that curator. We had 11 curators plus a vice president working on this. So we had, interesting. I think that would be a word we would stick with.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about the way we structured the exhibition is there's no actual 201, you know, object. It wasn't we sat down and said, okay, this is the most important, and this is second most important, and this is third most important.
Okay.
Since we had pretty much all of our curators, our curator of paleobiology, our curator of fine art, our curator of social history. I'm a curator of cultural history, which is essentially written history. We all brought our own perspectives and our own agenda to the meetings. So in conversations, we would often set up the category first and then say, okay, what do we have that plugs into this category? I mentioned Bad to the Bone. I think my favorite, it's my 17-year-old daughter's least favorite because she hates bad dad puns, is heavy metal.
Uh-huh.
We have a Rolls-Royce jet engine manufactured here in Indianapolis in
Excellent.
The exhibition. It's actually a drone engine that you see on 60 Minutes or on the nightly news. That's obviously literally a chunk of heavy metal. We also have Izzy Stradlin's guitar.
Okay. Which is also a different type of heavy metal.
A different type of heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
We started out with a heavy drone engine. We said, what is this? What's this represent? Rolls-Royce is something that people are going to identify. A military drone is something that people are going to recognize.
Yeah.
What is this? Well, it's a big chunk of metal. It's heavy metal. We have a Guns N' Roses guitar in the collection. That's about as heavy metal as it gets. And those kind of things, just kind of playing back and forth off each other, just bouncing things.
That had to be a lot of fun.
It really was. In looking back on it, at the time, it was a challenge because everybody was trying to get
I'm sure everyone had their must-have
they
item.
Did.
Or,
and we had situations where we had 12 people talking all at the same time. But looking back on it, I'd say it was probably about as much fun as I've had putting an exhibition together in the 30 years I've been at the State Museum.
What was a must-have item for you that you maybe fought for a little bit or really made sure that you were able to get included in the show?
We borrowed three artifacts from the National Archives.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a really good relationship through our work in the Abraham Lincoln Collection. We have one of the outstanding Lincoln collections in the country. And we've done multiple exhibitions on Abraham Lincoln, his family, his times.
Right.
And through that, through those projects, we've developed a really good relationship with the National Archives. From them, we borrowed the Treaty of Greenville. Which was signed between General Anthony Wayne and the various Native American tribes in this area after the Battle of Fallen Timbers. Little Turtle was the principal war chief representing the Native Americans. That's signed by George Washington as well. Hmm. It's one of the principal, not only one of the principal treaties with the Native Americans in American history, but one of the principal treaties in American history with any nation.
Obviously such a big part of ours.
Very much so. Brought Ohio and parts of Indiana and Michigan and really sort of opened up the Midwest to American control. That document has not been on exhibit for more than 50 years.
Hmm.
It's a real statement about the Indiana State Museum that the National Archives would lend a document of that importance.
Yes.
And a document that's been displayed as infrequently as that has to the Indiana State Museum. So we're very, very proud of that. They also loaned us an original printed copy of the Northwest Ordinance, which is another one of the founding documents of the country, and also the congressional resolution that when it was signed by President James Madison made Indiana the 19th state in the Union. Those are three really, even more than Indiana documents, those are three...
National importance right there.
Three documents of national importance, and to be able to work with an institution like the National Archives at that level, I think really should be a point of pride for Hoosiers everywhere.
That's awesome. That's great. So many interesting objects, some quirky, some of great national historic importance. What's for you one that stands out as being maybe a little surprising or maybe surprising to audiences, like when they come in and see the show?
Hopefully about 150 of them, I think.
That's great. Okay.
We have Johnny Appleseed's drinking flask on loan to us from the History Center in Fort Wayne.
Okay.
That's surprising from a couple of different aspects. A lot of people don't really realize that Johnny Appleseed was a real person.
Mm-hmm.
They think he was like Paul Bunyan or this mythological character. John Chapman was actually a missionary in this area who used apples and apple orchards as part of his mission. A lot of people don't realize that Johnny Appleseed is a real human being, let alone that he spent a big portion of the latter part of his life in Indiana and died while he was living in Allen County and is buried in Allen County. So that's surprising from a couple of different aspects. We have the state's electric chair, which is Old Sparky, on loan to us from the Department of Corrections. That was surprising to me that we were able to get our hands on that. It's got a really interesting story. The state's original gallows were made from the state's original hanging tree. When the hanging tree died, they cut it down, took it apart, and built gallows out of it. The electric chair is made out of the gallows. They visited Sing Sing Prison in New York.
That's an odd heritage.
It's a bizarre heritage. But part of Indiana's heritage is part of the story. It's part of who we are and where we came from. And I think is one of those things that people will see and make them think about what really goes into the history of the state of Indiana.
You know, one thing I've really been enjoying the past few weeks, about once a week, I guess it is, Will Higgins in the Indianapolis Star is writing a piece about one of the objects.
Sure.
That's a great addition to sort of keep the whole story alive and kind of it's a nice teaser if you haven't seen the show yet.
Will's been a good friend of the museum for a while. And what I really like about what Will's doing is he's really digging deeper into the individual objects and not just sort of reprinting our press releases. He's starting out with the information that we provide and really looking deeper into it, contacting people who might be associated with the artifact and finding out a little bit more about the story.
Yeah.
And that's really gratifying because we don't claim to know every single thing there is to know about every single object that we exhibit. And when somebody takes the time and the interest to say, this is really great, and by the way, I found out something else that's really cool too.
Right.
And that's fun for us. And Will's doing a great job of kind of going back and forth between the objects that are pretty serious components of Indiana history, things like a robe from the Ku Klux Klan, some things that are pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Two other things like a gasoline-powered pogo stick.
Right.
that aren't quite so heavy and are a little lighter and a little more just fun. This is a celebration of Indiana's 200 years. So we want people to have fun with it, but we also want them to think seriously about the history of the state. So we kind of go back and forth a little bit. I don't think it's maybe quite as chaotic as that might sound,
mm-hmm.
But we do like to present things because they were fun. This is something you didn't know about Indiana, and it's really a lot of fun.
Well, before I let you go, let me ask you about the pogo stick, the gasoline-powered pogo stick. What category does that end up in?
The Need for Speed. It's in the same area with a Peregrine Falcon and Mario Andretti's Indianapolis 500 fire suit.
Awesome. Dale, thanks so much for coming into Art the Matter today.
Great to
chatting
here,
with you about this great exhibit at the State Museum.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Travis DiNicola with Dale Ogden, Chief Curator of the Indiana State Museum. You can visit Indiana in 200 Objects through the rest of the year, and more information is at indianamuseum.org. Again, indianamuseum.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll preview this year's Installation Nation exhibit.
That's so fun to say. I'll talk with Janet Allen about her 20th anniversary at the IRT and what the new season has in store.
And then I'll take a look at the Indianapolis Arts Center's summer exhibition, Art from the Heartland. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.